David Stefano and myself are proud to welcome esteemed lecturer in leadership and management, Dr. Matt Offord. Matt is from the Adam Smith Business School at Glasgow University. A former naval officer with extensive experience leading agile 21st century teams in high-tech and data-rich environments. He's also published research into agile information and data-based leadership behaviours and informal decision-making networks, and is a regular speaker on data-driven leadership and communication at the UK Defence Academy. He's designed training around the world and recently delivered Train the Trainer and mentoring courses for the health sector in the Middle East for Kaplan Leadership. A leadership scholar with an MBA in leadership studies from Strathclyde Business School and a PhD from Durham University Business School. Matt conducted his early career research into training methods used by the Royal Navy from the University of Oxford as a Hudson Fellow from 2016 to 2017. And it was at this point when Matt started teaching in higher education. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you. That was very generous, actually. Thank you. I'm very interested in the whole concept of Nordic leadership, and I'd be very interested to find out more about that. Is leadership different in the North? Leadership tends, in my experience, tends to be different places anyway. So geographically and professionally and all the rest of it. So I think that's quite interesting.
They characterised the Nordic countries or Scandinavian Nordic, you know, as one group. And what we spend in our business, spend a fair bit of time, is actually working with Nordic teams. And then you find that the Finnish and Swedish leadership style, for example, although they're neighbours and they have a lot in common, they also make decisions quite differently.
Interesting.
And they have a different concept of how the leadership is going to work.
That's very interesting. I do a talk about at the Battle of Trafalgar and Nelson about the different leadership approaches from the French and Spanish and from Nelson specifically, because Nelson had this kind of band of brothers approach to leadership. Basically, the idea is that because they planned everything Trafalgar beforehand in quite a flat sort of structure, Nelson wasn't particularly big on hierarchy. He encouraged his sea captains to challenge him. They formulated the idea so that whereas the French and Spanish relied on the old method of sending commands visually to each ship from the commander. So if they couldn't see the commander, which with all the smoke and flying masts and falling sails and body parts flying all over the place, they couldn't often see the actual mast with the signals. But with Nelson, with the Royal Navy Grand Fleet at that time, they didn't need to because they already knew what to do beforehand and they were able to operate autonomously, the different ships and the sea captains. And that's often been put down as one of the key reasons for the success of the Battle of Trafalgar. I think this sort of information leadership was important.
Quite a nice metaphor for what today is this kind of distributed leadership, purpose mission-based leadership. So if people know where they're going, then they can take faster decisions and go there anyway, despite the leader not being there.
Yeah, I guess it was about speed of decision-making when you're in that moment with masts and bodies flying around and smoke and sails.
It's constraining because if you've got a centralized decision-making process, which is more efficient in many ways and was very often the response to industrial age problems, was that you would have this centralized decision making. But because they all knew what they were doing, they didn't need to. So it's much, much quicker because people have the information to hand. So they can just get on with it. They don't need to cycle information backwards and forwards to the boss. And that's a much better, no, I shouldn't say better, because every situation is different. And a lot of businesses today still use a very hierarchical model, and there might be very good reasons for it. But if you're in a very data-rich environment where everybody's sharing that information collectively at the same time, it seems a bit redundant to email the boss before you get permission to do something that you already knew that you had to do anyway. It's much quicker to get on with it. So I think that's where we are, and that's why that particular example is often cited as an early example of information age leadership by Command and Control scholars.
And on that note, maybe a good place to start, reflecting on your career in the Royal Navy. What can you tell us about leadership and training, the investment in training back then when you were in the Navy compared to what you experience today?
I left the Navy in 2018, so not like terribly long time ago. In my time in the Navy, we worked with a lot of partners that built various things or created the technology that we used. And my observation from my time in the Navy and my time working with these businesses, there was quite a big difference in exactly what you said, that investment in training, because particularly from a leadership point of view, I joined the Navy in 1989, I was 18 years of age, and you started straight away with your leadership training. And we did a 15 months worth of training before we actually go out to sea and start practicing things and what have you. But then you do more leadership training at each point where you get more senior and you get promoted. There's another raft of sort of leadership training. There's a lot of investment, and there's a sort of sense that we almost every time we bring in a new piece of equipment, we have to go and train to use that as well. And in fact, towards the end of my career, it got to the point where it got more and more professionalized. So you had to have the certificate to operate that. And leadership was similar as well. So every time you went to a new level, you'd have a different type of leadership. It would be more strategic, for example. So there would be courses. And for people who got much more senior than me, there were courses for them as well, for the really sort of strategic stuff. You know, starting from how do you look after a very small group of people doing this set task. We started off, like, for instance, when I first started, when I was 19, I'd be looking after some guys who were much older than me, and I'd be expected to help them out with their financial problems and things like that. And then it's a bit later, people realise that we really ought to qualify people to sort of give financial advice. So you find that you get more training in how to support people in that. Mental health, diversity, inclusivity, all of these things, data protection, all of these things which actually do feed into leadership, because it's how you look after your people. And you get plenty of training on that as well. And
Matt, sorry to interrupt, but is that the point, what you just said there, how to look after people? Yeah. You can see differences in terms of how it was back then for you as a 19-year-old and maybe what you see today in the corporate world.
Yeah, I think that generally everything you do is through people. I was a mine clearance diver, so I would go out in very small teams, perhaps five or six people in a small rubber boat, and go and dive on a mine. And it wasn't always me that was diving on the mine. Sometimes I'd be supervising the dive. Sometimes I'd be attending the diver who was diving on the mine. We'd all switch around these different roles. But we all had to look after each other. It wasn't a kind of top-down kind of thing. It was we had to look after each other because we all relied on each other. So it makes sense whether somebody was 100% that day or not, because really your welfare depended on that as well. So I think you get used to first and foremost looking after the team, because without the team you can't really do much else. When I joined, we used this leadership model, which is John Adair's action-centered leadership model, which was task, team, and individual. And these are the three things that you have to make sure that you're looking after if you want to get a job done. But I'd say that the team features foremost in that, because without the team you can't work, you can't look after your individuals if they're not part of a functioning team, and you can't get the task done without the team. And I've noticed that is generally different when I go into businesses, and quite often I think from a leadership training point of view it becomes quite difficult, because like in the military, leadership training was a self-apparent sort of thing to do. It was obvious why you were doing it. When you start running your own business as a consultant, to justify why you're giving a leadership training, it's a little bit of a difference in that sort of mindset, because you find yourself for the first time explaining why you think leadership is important.
Yeah, it's incredible,
isn't
it?
What the value of it is.
In the corporate world, you maybe have a 5 to 10 year career of doing the job and selling the thing and supporting the thing and talking to customers, and then maybe you have a chance for promotion, and then bang, you've got this new job and you have to look after people, and then you'll get something called leadership training or coaching.
Yeah,
exactly. If I can ask, what did that do for you, having that leadership training?
Yeah, I think it taught me to be always mindful of my leadership and how I'm being led as well, because I think there is that there is that other aspect to it in the military, is that we do encourage people to challenge leaders as well. And in fact, it's even seen as a kind of a duty to challenge a leader if something is quite obviously not right. So there's this kind of leadership followership thing, which becomes an instinct and an ever-present kind of part of your thought process in everything you do. So you don't think just about, how am I going to get that done? It's like, how do I look after the team that are actually going to be doing the hard work? But I suppose the downside is that it becomes so instinctive that you're not used to explaining it. So when, as a consultant, was asked to look at certain interventions, I had to learn a whole new skill, which was justifying and evaluating. If you're going to take away, if you can take people out of their workplace for a certain period of time, then to be fair, there has to be a good reason for doing it. And you can't just say, because it's all good leadership stuff, you do have to justify it. So I think that was the downside of it. But I think that's massively outweighed by just that sort of real team focus, I think, is so important. And I've found increasingly outside of the forces, that's much rarer. People talk a lot about teamwork, but then you go into workplaces and it's not really happening so much.
Yeah, we've noticed that on a few occasions. What I find interesting is the idea of challenge leadership. Yeah. That was something that people were encouraged to do. Mm. And that's not something it's not the kind of message that, for example, Hollywood gives us about military, Navy, Air Force. So that's interesting for me. So then thinking about that, you know, challenging leadership and about crisis communications. Mm-hmm. What happens when people get under pressure, when situations become tense? What can you tell us about that?
I'm very happy to talk about that because I actually did some research on this. I was very lucky. We were talking about investment, and the Navy actually funded me through a PhD, which again, I think is probably, there are not many organizations that would do that. So I was doing a PhD and I did some studying into, it was about really about prestige as a different concept to hierarchical leadership. So it's informal leadership where people lead because they're prestigious people, they're respected people, rather than occupying a specific leadership position. And as part of that research, I went down to the other end of the world, down in the sub-Antarctic, around the Falkland Islands, to look at Royal Navy ships and how their leadership was basically expressed in crisis situations. So they did quite frequent training throughout the Navy, really. Ships are constantly pretending, if you like, to be at war and practicing all their drills. And they have to not only be able to engage the enemy, but also they have to be able to sort of fight fires and deal with floods and casualties and the sort of inevitable consequences of being in that situation. So I would fly down there, and because I was part of the training team, and we would put a ship's company, as it's called, like the, what we might say is a crew, but they call it the ship's company, through their paces. And they'd be put under a lot of pressure. But the research that I did was looking at whether people were listened to and whether their voices were heard in amongst all that clamour and chaos. And I wanted to see whether they were listened to based on their rank or whether they were based on, whether it's based on some sort of prestige. So I went and measured the prestige amongst the ship's company. So I went and asked every member of the ship's company and created a kind of advice network. Who were the people that people went to for advice? And then I wanted to see what their role was in this chaos. And what I discovered was that although rank, generally speaking, if people are of a high rank, then people will listen to them by virtue of that authority position. But then there are also sort of high prestige individuals who are also listened to, even though they may be a lower rank. Basically, if somebody discovered, for instance, a casualty in a certain part of the ship, and they would go running up to the incident control point where all this chaos would be breaking loose, and they're all trying to collect all these data about what's going on, what compartments are flooded and what pieces of equipment are not working anymore and all this kind of thing. And there's usually one person who's the captain trying to make decisions around this. And what I found was that if a prestigious person came to the bridge and said, look, I've got new information, you need to listen to this, everything would go quiet and they would listen to. Whereas some people would do the same thing and they would just basically ignored or quite often hustled off the bridge or something like that, regardless of what their kind of actual rank was. And by and large, because the Navy's got a very good history and knowledge of how to use these hierarchies, there's a lot of redundancy, so a lot of information is collected in different ways. But I just wanted to look at this prestigious thing. And then I took that idea and created a simulation, a computer simulation, of how information spreads through the ship and then distorted the kind of hierarchy, if you like. So I had one where you would have information in a normal hierarchical setup that the military has, another one where all the sailors, like the lower down ranks, they had more prestige than anybody else. So I had a bottom heavy version and a top heavy version and just a flat structure. And I found that the flat structure actually disseminated information far quicker, about twice as quick as the other three conditions. So when we're in these kind of specific situations where we want information to be spread very quickly, then we need to practice a less hierarchical approach, which wasn't really that surprising, because everybody thinks that the military is super hierarchical, but actually, especially modern militaries tend to be administratively quite hierarchical, but operationally reasonably flat. Information moves pretty quickly round the structure.
Yeah, the idea of those informal influences, David will know more than me, but I think this kind of work is coming more and more into corporate speak. David, what have you heard so far?
Interesting things. Last one is most interesting, the informal influences, and it is something that we work with clients on, that as you know, just finding out how change actually happens and who are the ones that you really need to get on board, and noticing how much naval metaphor is in the English language, getting people on board. Actually, English is absolutely...
Don't rock the boat.
Yes, it's studied with naval imagery and language. I think that really is interesting. What happens when the informal leader, the influencer, as Nick put it, is actually not on the same page as the formal hierarchy?
Yeah, I think that's okay. I think that's the good thing about it. So what my recommendations and conclusions from that study were, that this informal network is not in contradiction or doesn't contest the formal hierarchy, it actually works alongside it. What I noticed was that if you have a very steep hierarchical gradient, it can be very efficient. Information moves downwards very quickly, but it's trying to get information up. If the decision makers need to know what's going on at the coal face, then the hierarchical method is not the fastest. Usually the conduit are these trusted people, and I use the word trust there because I think the decision makers learn who these individuals are, and they learn to listen when they hear novel information. So I think that if that information contradicts something that they've already said, I don't think that's a problem, because particularly in an operational environment in warfighting, but I think in business as well, whether you've got that chaos and that kind of fog, that's when you need to listen to people who are telling you something different to the narrative, whatever the narrative may be. And I think we've experienced quite often in business, in politics, in the military, where a narrative can really derail a project or a venture because they really believe that this is how it is. And actually what we need is people to challenge that. Personally, I think the two work together, both the formal and informal, usually. In a good organisation, anyway.
Sometimes it can be the cultures with a high power distance, with a really top-down formal structure, they can be very good at getting messages upwards.
Yeah.
I think just off the top of my head, Japanese approach to teamwork. So the Japanese have quite formal top-down power structures, but they do get messages out from the... Yeah,
absolutely. And they have things like quality circles come from Japan, for example. It's that idea of harnessing that informal power as well. I think as long as it's acknowledged and they don't try to stamp it out, I think it's a very healthy thing. I think the idea that informal networks are not helpful is not helpful. Because quite often I think people in businesses, they just want to get things done, same as the hierarchy do, same as the leaders do. They want to get things done so that they can go home at night and what have you. So I think it's quite interesting, like what Henry Mintzberg quite often said, that people get things done despite the kind of bureaucracy of a company. And that's been my experience as well to some extent. You go in these businesses where the hierarchy is saying, this is what we want to do and these are the ways we want you to do it. And the people on the work, or the shop floor, should we say, are saying, yes, I agree, that's what we should do. However, there's no way in a month of Sundays we're going to be able to do it that way. So we'll just do it this other way. and I think that's quite interesting as well.
I was also curious about you and your journey from the Navy into academia. And so when you're in the Navy, you're a mine clearance diver, you had very clear operations and what you were getting stuff done. What's your mission now in academia? What do you want to get done?
Yeah, for me, most academics both do research and teaching. For me, I really enjoy teaching. My main role, I feel personally, is teaching. And I teach leadership and management, right from undergraduates, postgraduates, and executive education, where you're working with businesses as well.
So I was also curious to know what Mr. Moscone was hearing and thinking.
Yeah, thinking many things. I like this finding the influencers inside the organization and try to game the organization through those. It's funny because in one of my many interviews, I was asked, so how do you get stuff done? I told, look, there is a real organization and there is the coffee table organization. And I like to work with both. I like to work with the coffee table organization and try to get stuff done through the coffee table. Yeah. So I've seen this kind of playing out in the companies which I worked in the past. So you might actually get the order or the blessing from the boss. But if you don't know what is the coffee table thinking, then there's no way you're going to get anything done. That's something which I really, really like because it plays into my experience. One other area that I would like to explore a bit, because my trade is in engineering and analyzing data and all of that. You use a data-driven leadership and it sounds quite innovative. So can you open up a bit more that?
Yeah, sure. When I was doing my PhD, I had to learn a lot of data management, if you like, data science even. I was quite often asked, or when I asked about data, I was told that data is a problem. There's just too much of it. We don't know what to do with it all. It's overwhelming. And my observation about that was that it's perceived as something we can't control. There's just lots and lots of it. We don't really know what to do with it. And I just thought to myself, why can't we have an information supply chain, the same as we have supply chains for everything else? And why don't we approach it in the same way, where we try to minimize waste? And one of the things I noticed going in as a consultant was that a lot of businesses, when they treat their data or when they're dealing with their data, will quite often look to technology to resolve those issues, which normally means procuring something new. So we might have started off with some spreadsheets back in the day, and then we might have had a database, and then we might have had ERP systems, and now we have data lakes and Hadoop and all of this kind of thing. But companies tend to layer these sort of technologies one over the other. I would typically find myself working for a company which would have one database and another database, but the two databases wouldn't talk to each other. So they had to port the information using an Excel spreadsheet. Very, very intensive. A lot of work just doing data input, wrangling their data and then putting it into another spreadsheet or into another database, which didn't talk to their ERP system. And there's a lot of data and a lot of time that's wasted around that. And in particular, I felt that there's the data management work, the data wrangling that's going on, that project engineers and project managers are working on, data scientists, data managers, and then there's the leadership. And the leadership are doing something different. And don't the leaders need the data to make the decisions? But I think like the traditional view of leadership is not somebody poring over a spreadsheet. So I think for many leaders, they don't want to get too involved in the data. They don't see that as a leadership task. And one of the classics I saw was a software engineer once creating a really nice data dashboard, which would take all of the data and create these sort of dashboard things. He was doing that work on his own. He had no access to the leadership. So he could create a nice dashboard, but he didn't know what to put on the dashboard because he didn't know what the strategic leaders needed to make those decisions. So you've got this very industrial stovepipe approach to things where the data is over there, the leadership is over here, and we're not seeing the two things come together. So I'm running a course with FutureLearn and University of Glasgow called Data-Driven Leadership Skills, where basically it's not about data, but it's about how the leaders deal with data. And I start off by looking at the traditional view of leadership, the sort of Platonic view of leaders as authoritarian decision makers, quite masculinized, heroic view of leaders, and then take them forward to the 21st century and say, is this helpful or is it less helpful? So, and then give them some tools and techniques for how to manage data and to use data in a leadership. So yeah, to be a data, what I call a data savvy leader.
And I think I've seen this firsthand many times. The issue is that the software engineer who's creating the dashboard doesn't know what he should put in there. And at the same time, the leader doesn't know what he could get out of the engineer or the database or at the dashboard. And then it takes someone who tries to connect on both sides, the engineer and the leader, and say, hey, so why do you need something? Another thing is this kind of traditional leadership style versus 21st century leadership. And I see that conflict, by the way. And I see that democratization of data inside the companies and inside the world is actually challenging the traditional leadership style.
Yes.
So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I normally go to, when I talk about that particular issue, I agree with that. I think that it goes back to what we were saying, where it's about the speed of information. And in order to maintain an authority type of leadership, you have to slow the system down so that you can reinforce it. And I think a lot of businesses don't really have the time for that. They're rather just, we've got all these data, we've got this software, you know, we've got these systems, let's use them. So I think that's where that kind of tension lies. But I quite often go back to going back to my military roots and some of my PhD research. It was quite interesting that after 9/11, the US military in particular wanted to try and build in some more agile decision making so that particularly for people on the ground, that they could make more decisions more quickly without having to cycle all the information back up. So they sponsored this thing called the Command and Control. It's called Command and Control Research Project. And if you Google it, you'll find it. And also you'll find quite a lot of their research reports and books and things that they wrote. They were looking for this much more agile decision making. They called it Power to the Edge. There was Albert and Hayes were the authors of this book called Power to the Edge in 2003, and they are command and control scholars. They wrote this book called Power to the Edge, and it's the whole idea is that instead of the power residing in the center of the organization, we would move some of this power out to the edge so that people on the edge, i.e. the coalface, could make more decisions more quickly and not be encumbered by this hierarchy. So this is, by definition, a democratization of the decision-making process. Not necessarily for ethical reasons, but more for just operational and, if not efficiency, but responsive reasons. Because actually it's not a very efficient way of doing things, because you have a lot of noise in that network. You have a lot of people talking to each other, and a lot of those conversations don't go anywhere. So it's not massively efficient, but it is, it's sharing, and it's much more responsive. And like a lot of things nowadays are done online, they're done in chat rooms. How many decisions are made on WhatsApp now? I think it's quite interesting because most of human history, we've not really lived in hierarchies. A lot of people will say, this is traditional. This is how leadership is done. You have a leader, you have followers, this is how it is. But if you look at any small scale human society, that's not the case. They don't like being told what to do. Against the idea of having a hierarchy. And for most 12,000 years of relatively modern human history, it's been like that. There's only been a few kind of periods, like the last couple of hundred years, where there's been these strong hierarchies. So I wonder whether data and technology is sort of changing the game, and we're reverting more back to what might be more natural, perhaps.
Interesting thought. Matt, this seems like a ridiculously simple question. What's the best way to teach leadership?
Yeah, okay. That's one of those questions, isn't it? It seems simple, but very hard. I think leadership tends to get wrapped up into other things. So people don't necessarily teach leadership, but they might teach I don't know, they could teach anything. It could be medicine or something like that, or it might be engineering. But at some point, leadership's going to come up, because if you're training as a doctor, at some point, you're going to have to lead people as well. So no doubt that's going to come up. So I think it really helps to put it into practical context. So what does leadership mean for you and for your learners? How are they going to go and apply it? And one of the classic things, particularly 80s and 90s, where people would go away and do leadership courses and they come back all super enthused and good to go. Oh, we've done this fantastic leadership course. And then a few weeks later, that whole thing has just dissipated and it's run dry and it's lost its momentum, because it was all about leadership and it was all about hanging off rocks and climbing or skiing or something like that. It didn't really have anything to do with the workplace. And I think a lot of modern leadership interventions are now much more about the workplace and about the specific problems that they have in that particular business. Because you can get people from a business to talk about the problems they've got quite easily and they'll be quite animated. Whereas if you teach through a series of PowerPoints, you're not really going to have that same impact, I don't think, unless it's part of something else which leads to engagement, passion, that kind of thing.
I think you're right. It has evolved a lot, the teaching of leadership, and it is firmly rooted in the client's context these days.
What would happen if everybody got leadership training from day one? What change would we see in the corporate?
I think what leadership might do is to allow people to check across different departments and learn those. It's that interaction between different silos and moving out of that immersion and looking across the business and looking at people and teams and how they're going to work together. I think that what leadership does is it forces people out of those kind of stovepipes and gets them to think about people. So I think in any highly specialized industry, I think having that leadership training at the beginning will allow them to check what they're doing against what the organization is doing and what the people are doing together. Mm. And I think that would be...
Mm.
It comes back to Stefano's role there in being between the data and the leader. I think it would be nice if leaders could do that for themselves.
Matt, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for answering that one. And thank you for being with us today.
No, you're very welcome. Thank you so much for the opportunity. It's been lovely